Good morning. Please be seated.
Are you going to sit way down there?
Oh.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Chief Judge Bonnie Bulla of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and with me today in Las Vegas are Judge Michael Gibbons and Judge Deborah Westbrook. This is the date and time set for oral argument in case number 89614 in the matter of Stumbo versus Stumbo. Participating in Las Vegas, we have attorney James Jimerson on behalf of appellant Logan Stumbo and attorney Amanda Roberts on behalf of Margaret Stumbo. Counsel, could you please identify anyone with you at counsel table today? Thank you. So each party is limited to 15 minutes of argument. Mr. Jimerson, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal? Very good. You may proceed.
We are here because the district court made two fundamental errors in issuing its decision on custody and relocation. The district court improperly restricted appellant's ability to present expert testimony concerning relocation, and even more significantly, the district court improperly relied upon arguments of counsel and treated them as substantive evidence to the detriment of not only Mr. Stumbo, but also the children in rendering a decision on both physical custody and relocation. Reading from paragraph 8 of the district court's decision, defendant's closing brief obviates everything that he had impressed the court with previously. The court had been impressed with the way defendant had seemed to give plaintiff credit and take accountability for certain actions and behaviors. All of this was thrown out the window with the vitriol of his closing brief. Defendant's doubling down on his attacks against plaintiff largely impacts the court's discretion to award joint physical custody, as well as the court's ability to deny plaintiff's relocation request. Based off the tone of defendant's final brief, it would be an abuse of discretion to deny plaintiff's request. That's right. The district court deemed the vitriol of counsel's closing brief to be dispositive on the issue of physical custody and relocation.
Mr. Jimerson.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which of the court's best interest findings and relocation factor findings were based on the tone of the closing brief?
They
actually referenced it in that analysis.
The court did not specifically reference the closing brief in the two factors that were in favor of the respondent, specifically factors D and F, the conflict of the parties, as well as the ability to meet the emotional and physical and developmental needs of the child, or in this case, the children. However, the conflict of the parties, while the court didn't specifically state the word brief, made repeated references to the demeaning communications and the aggressive tenor that the court was concerned about before trial, but that the court was obviously impressed with the way that Mr. Stumbo had appropriately approached the matter and had grown. As the district court said, the judge focused on accountability. But when the court then throws out all of those positive impressions because of arguments of an attorney, when this court just 5 months ago said, sua sponte, that it was appropriate for the court to evaluate whether or not the district court effectively punished a litigant because of the arguments made by counsel or what they did not believe, because the court did not believe that the arguments made by counsel were appropriate, that would invite plain error were the court not to evaluate it. I specifically referenced Pearson versus Pearson, which we had cited in our notice of supplemental authorities that we filed earlier yesterday, which had been decided after the full and complete briefing in this matter. I specifically reference the line, even if the court disagreed with John's decision to relocate, or believe that John made improper arguments in support of relocation. Those beliefs should not have affected the court's custody determination.
Well, counsel, didn't the Supreme Court take that up on a petition for review?
I do not know, Your Honor. The question would be then whether or not then it would be appropriate for there to be any form of reversal on that matter. I would respectfully submit to this court that it would be inappropriate for counsel arguments to be effectively a replacement.
Mr. Jimerson, what relief would you want us to consider if we agree with you on the first point that it was inappropriate for the district court to take into consideration counsel's argument in making determinations on best interest factors? What relief are you asking?
I'd ask for two interrelated points. Number one, that a reversal include instructions that there should be a complete, I guess, you would pretend as if there were the closing briefs never happened, and that the court would reevaluate without those matters, but also to reopen evidence, because if the court had been tainted by that brief, that the party should have the opportunity to address the same. In many ways, you cannot unring that bell, because if the last thing the court hears, and as the court treated it in its own brief, in its own decision, it stated, the closing briefs are the final word of each party. Defendants effectively said to forget every concession, positive thing that has been previously stated regarding plaintiff, his growth and his promises for change, and hammer her on the same issues that have been before the court since the inception of the case.
So can we turn to your first point regarding expert testimony? Because that seems to be one of the points of contention. And I'm assuming if you said remand it, you'd want to reopen the discovery part of this case.
Certainly, Your Honor.
But the problem is that there was no scheduling order. Or can you point to me in the record where there was one, where the parties agreed to a specific expert disclosure deadline? And if the parties could not agree on what the expert could do, in this case, potentially interview the parties, why wasn't that issue brought before the discovery commissioner, which is what the district court said had to happen if the parties had a dispute?
Yes, Your Honor. To answer the first question, there was no scheduling order entered, and there was no EDCR 5601 stipulation concerning an expert disclosure deadline. The court had entered orders effectively telling the parties, please agree or please reach agreements concerning scheduling. And there had been an agreement effectively by virtue of the briefing that there was a close of discovery on March 24, and that simply by virtue of NRCP 16.2, 60 days prior would be the deadline to submit and serve initial expert disclosures, which 60 days prior to March 24 would be in January. However, the issue of relocation had not been put to the fore until February 2. And as a result, you now have a compressed discovery period on a relocation issue, which obviously would warrant more than 45 days of discovery.
But what would have prevented the parties from addressing this issue before the discovery commissioner, even if it was, I mean, if you look at the rule, it says the report is due 60 days after the close of discovery, but experts have to be disclosed 90 days after the initial financial disclosures are due. So let's just set aside the deadlines for a minute. What would have prevented the parties from addressing this issue regarding expert testimony, the scope of it, prior to the time of the commencement of the trial, and certainly well prior to the time of the close of discovery deadline that the parties apparently agreed to, but we do not have a scheduling order?
To answer your question, Your Honor, obviously there were many ways that they could have teed this issue up. The choice that the appellant had made was to address this particular issue in the form of two motions, a motion for declaratory relief as well as a motion to continue trial, both of which were filed in March. The declaratory relief issue dealt with the parameters of what the court would order, would or would not order, concerning compelling the parties to both submit to a potential expert, in this case, Dr. Holland, for evaluation, for her evaluation, and ultimately upon which she would render an opinion. From there, because Dr. Holland had expressed her need for approximately 90 days to perform this analysis, to do this work, there needed to be a continuation of trial, which obviously would not be something for the discovery commissioner. Moreover, to the extent that there would need to be any continuation of discovery deadlines, given that there had not been any order concerning discovery deadlines, it would be appropriate for the district court to deal with the issue directly via their motion for declaratory judgment or declaratory relief. And as the district court would absolutely have the authority in the first instance to make a determination as to whether or not it would compel the parties to appear before a potential expert for evaluation.
Mr. Jimerson, yes. I know you weren't the counsel below or didn't write the briefs,
right.
Below the question of constitutional issues was raised, due process, because of the failure to identify whether the Ms. Stumbo was moving for relocation. And it was late. It was very late. And so counsel moved for a continuance. Again, the constitutional issue was raised. Now on appeal, it's presented with the standard of abuse of discretion, denying a motion to continue. But the argument is primarily a constitutional one. It appears that the constitutional argument is being made because it's subject to de novo review by our court. So we look at it anew, as opposed to abuse of discretion, which is the typical standard for a motion to continue, granted or denied. So what exactly is your argument? Is it abuse of discretion, due process, or both? And if it's due process, is it substantive due process related to a liberty interest, a fundamental right to parent your child, or is it procedural due process under notice and opportunity to be heard?
I always get worried when I've got to use the term substantive due process. But the short answer is, it is both. First of all, obviously, the initial determination as to whether or not to deny or to grant a continuance of trial is left to the discretion of the district court. However, when the effect of the denial would have constitutional implications, would infect whether or not due process was actually being provided to both sides, that is where the court's de novo review would come in. That is, when we deal with the issues for which there is a fundamental liberty interest, in this case, the right of a parent to exercise custody of their children, and when a court is resolving whether or not to grant or deny a relocation, which would in effect deny one parent joint physical custody, when the failure to grant the continuance of trial so infects the case so as to prevent there from being an actual determination of the merits, that is, whether or not the court would have had all of the facts necessary to answer the questions that it would have to answer, that would be the reason why this court would conduct a de novo review on the same, because of the implications.
So I have a quick question, Mr. Jimerson. Was there any other reason for the requested continuance aside from Logan's desire to conduct the expert relocation evaluation?
That was the primary reason. Obviously, with the additional time, you'd have the ability to take additional discovery into other matters. However, the principal reason for the request and the timeline for the request was based upon Dr. Holland's prediction of a 90-day window to prepare the report.
And then as a follow-up, due process requires notice and an opportunity to be heard. Do you have any case law or legal authority to support the proposition that the district court was required to order Margaret to participate in that relocation evaluation by Logan's expert, as opposed to by a neutral for both parties?
Short answer is there's nothing specifically on point to that. However, when we deal with, for example, in this situation, on a compressed timeline, and when one party is refusing steadfastly to even engage any sort of experts or even to participate for the benefit of even looking to the appellant's chosen expert, when the idea is I'm going to sit on my hands and do nothing and be benefited and profit from the deadlines and the timeline that the court has, that would cause the court to say, well, how are we to go about doing our business, right? Is there to be an adverse inference for refusing to participate? Right? No one is saying that she must participate, you know, or else she goes to jail. No. Okay. But the question then becomes, what are the implications if you do not?
But if the court determines what discovery is necessary, and the court here didn't deem an evaluation of mom to be necessary under the facts and circumstances of the case, how was it an abuse of discretion to deny the continuance and not force mom to undertake this examination?
The issue here, Your Honor, is the timing of the determination. The district court here had made the determination about what was necessary, what wasn't necessary, before they had the benefit of understanding the scope of the expert testimony. As was cited significantly or extensively in the briefing, the number of times the district court said, I don't find reports that don't involve one side to be reliable, but I'm also not going to order that person, the other side, to participate. The district court is leaving the appellant in a catch-22 situation in which you can have your expert, but I'm not really going to consider it because I'm not going to facilitate your ability to actually have a meaningful evaluation, or an evaluation that I would consider to be meaningful. And that is where the district court really got off the rails, is that by predetermining what would or what would not be helpful, it prevented the appellant from appropriately addressing these issues in full, as the court would expect in the ordinary.
Mr. Jimerson, you are out of time.
I
will consider giving you some rebuttal time. Let's see what develops.
Appreciate that.
Ms. Roberts.
May it please the court. Amanda Roberts for the respondent, Margaret Stumbo. I'm going to address first the expert request and the continuance. EDCR 5.406B is very specific. The court must determine that an expert evaluation is first necessary before it may consider whether or not to grant one. In this matter, if the court looks at the briefing that was done by, and I respect that the court already noted this, Mr. Jimerson and I were not counsel at that time. If the court looks at that briefing, the court will find that Logan did not set forth any legal standard for the court to consider his request for the expert to be granted. Furthermore, and that's the appendix at 675 and 686. Furthermore, at the hearing on April 15th, 2024, there was specific argument that there was no legal authority proposed by Logan that would support a request for an expert. It was raised at that time that the only way that that can be done is through an NRCP 35 request, which has never been made in this case to date. That was raised by Mr. Jones. That is in the transcript at appendix 931.
Ms. Roberts, why is this an NRCP 35 request, or the rule that you cited in your brief and again now? This was not a request for a psychological evaluation of Ms. Stumbo. It was nothing of the sort. It was a request to do an assessment for relocation. That means interviewing parties. It doesn't mean doing psychological testing that psychologists do. So that rule doesn't even apply. So the fact that there isn't a rule, does that mean you can't have your own expert to present your case? I mean, if your client had disclosed the fact of relocation in a timely manner, wouldn't this case have proceeded in the normal course? You identify your expert on one side and the other side objects. And then maybe it would go to the discovery commissioner. But that never happened. In fact, in the complaint, there was no request for relocation. There was no motion filed. At the hearing in November, there was a statement that there might be a relocation request. 30 days was discussed for revealing it. Nothing was presented. So my fundamental question is, and I know you weren't the counsel below, once your clients thought that she might be relocating and the decision was made to relocate, call the other side and say, we are going to be filing our relocation brief. We don't have it done yet, but it's going to happen. Why wasn't there that phone call? Instead, waiting until February to actually file the brief and spring it on the other side when the discovery time for identifying experts had already passed.
If the court looks at the transcripts, and I could get the court the specific appendix cite to that, Ms. Barnes, which was counsel for Logan at the time, indicated during arguments, I believe on the April 15th hearing, that they had discussed, Mr. Jones and Ms. Barnes, whether or not to do an expert. And they had discussed this well in advance of the request file, or sorry, the brief filed by Margaret and the motion filed by Logan. I would note for the court that it's true. She filed the brief on February 2nd of 2024. He then waited over 30 days to ask the court to take any action as it relates to the expert or continuing the trial.
Had to find an expert. 30 days is a long time. Again, my question is, why not send a letter, send an email? We are going to be moving for relocation. We haven't put it in our pleadings. We haven't filed anything, but I'll informally notify you it's coming so you can prepare accordingly. Just common sense counsel talking to each other.
So I can't speak to what happened between Mr. Barnes and Mr. Jones, Ms. Barnes and Mr. Jones. What I can speak to, Your Honor, is that I believe that the record.
It's not Ms. Barnes. It was Mr. Jones as counsel brought up the issue at the November hearing, the case management conference, and then never followed up on it till the brief was filed with anything in writing.
No, Your Honor.
So back to the other point. Why isn't there a scheduling order that would have set deadlines for these various things to happen so we don't have the mess that exists in this case?
So in this specific case, what happened regarding scheduling deadlines is that the district court ordered that the parties counsel were to meet and confer. That never happened. So prior counsel before Mr. Jimerson and I never met and conferred, never put together that scheduling order. And the order that was filed is completely devoid of that information. Mr. Stumbo's counsel was ordered to prepare it. It did not happen. So then Ms. Stumbo's counsel then prepared it, and that language was left out. I would be speculating, Your Honor, for me to answer the specific question why that was not there. As to that issue, I just don't know. I do know that they had talked about it before Mr. Jones filed the brief on behalf of Ms. Stumbo based upon the representations made at that hearing.
They talked about it, but was ever said, we are moving for relocation. She's going to New Jersey.
That would be speculation for me to answer that. I don't know what specific.
All we have in the record is there was a general discussion at the November conference, and we don't have anything after that in writing, absolutely nothing, until the brief is filed in February.
The representation at the April hearing is that they had conversations between that hearing in November and between the filing in February. That's the representation that Ms. Barnes made, I believe, in the record.
And this trial was, at that point, the trial date was in April.
Correct, Your Honor.
So how could that possibly be fair to the other side? Wait, sit on your hands, spring it on them, and the time might have passed. But if nothing else, to find an expert in a short period of time is not easy.
Your Honor, I don't think an expert is mandatory, first of all.
That's a different question. If the expert had been, if the relocation had been made known, then they could have identified their expert. Then the burden would have been on your client to object to the expert instead of putting the burden on the other side to move for a continuance and try and justify it because of the expert. It turned the whole procedure upside down.
I disagree, Your Honor. I don't think that it did. He could have done discovery if he believed that. And their record indicates that Ms. Barnes and Mr. Jones had communication before the filing of the brief in February of 2024.
Ms. Roberts, let me interrupt and ask this question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any legal authority that you are aware of that would require Margaret Stumbo to submit to some sort of interview with, in this case, I believe counsel mentioned it was Dr. Holland?
So they did include in the filings a list of what Dr. Holland was going to testify to at trial and what she wanted to do. That was a filing made shortly after briefing started. When the relocation request was made. In that situation, I think the only, and I understand what Your Honor is saying as to Rule 35, but I think that's the only way you can compel her to work with an expert to do some kind of assessment. The relocation risk assessment does have some psychological components to it, and I would assert that because of the manner in which it's done, it is a psychological evaluation that requires her to, maybe not an MMPI type evaluation, but it requires some kind of psychological evaluation, which is why a PsyD or PhD level is required for those.
Really, the focus is on the relocation issue. There is no argument by either side that either parent was unfit for custody, correct?
That's true.
So both parents could have exercised custody either jointly or primarily, depending on the relocation issue.
I do agree that that factor did not play into the court's decision. He did not find anything regarding that I recall pertaining to their mental and physical health of the parents.
So, for example, in NRS, I believe it's 16.22, if I'm correct on that, I apologize if I've cited it incorrectly. There is a procedure for an interview for custody purposes, but that wouldn't be something that we would be concerned about here. So that particular statute doesn't really give guidance, does it?
In my opinion, no, because they also agreed that they weren't, the court ordered they weren't going to use those deadlines. The court ordered them to find their own deadlines. So as it relates to that, I think that deals with the deadline 16.2 in particular.
But you said there was nothing. 16.22 is in the Rules of Civil Procedure for a custody evaluation. Custody was at issue in this case. The primary issue was relocation. Your client had originally asked for sole physical custody. Mr. Stumbo asked for joint physical custody. It was later changed, but the effect of it was if she moved, she would have custody. So custody was at issue in this case.
I don't dispute custody was at issue. That was the primary issue.
And there's a rule that allows for an evaluation, an assessment. It wasn't sought in this particular case. I agree with you on that point. But again, the burden was flipped. It was put on Mr. Stumbo because he had to file the motion to continue instead of you objecting.
But 16.2 doesn't require the court to grant an evaluation. It's all discretionary based upon whether it's necessary. And this court, Judge
Henry, burdens important?
I agree burdens are important, Your Honor. But again, in order for us to even have an evaluation, Judge Henderson would have had to find it was necessary. He did not think it was necessary. He said that in depth at the April 2024 hearing.
And then at trial, he said the opposite. He said this was important information. It was the best part of Mr. Stumbo's case. So what he did is he jumped the gun on it, made a off-the-cuff decision, oh, I won't need this. And then when he actually had the trial, he said, oh, it is important.
Well, they did agree at the subsequent hearings that as to what Dr. Holland would be able to testify about and be able to present hypotheticals about. So that information was given to the court, and the court ruled on that based upon the stipulation of the parties.
Right, and nothing about the facts of the case could be admitted through the expert. All she could talk about is generalities.
I acknowledge that, Your Honor.
Was the expert actually hired by Mr. Stumbo's attorney?
The expert was hired by Mr. Stumbo at the hearing in April. She said they had paid him, I believe, $7,500 already to start the process, and he had already started with the interviews of Mr. Stumbo.
Did the record, or does the record reflect exactly when the hire date of the expert was?
There was a filing of designation of expert on March 22nd of 2024. It doesn't say when it started, but that's when she designated it. It's between 705 in the appendix and 931. That also had all of the information that they asked that Dr. Holland be permitted to testify to, which ultimately was the scientific materials. And they agreed that Dr. Holland would testify regarding the scientific materials. What Dr. Holland did not do were the interviews of the parties, which the court found that the court could not compel Margaret to do.
What is the purpose of that type of an interview? What would be the purpose of that interview?
In this case, in a relocation risk assessment, there is a study by an expert called Austin. It is a study that is very dated, as pointed out by Mr. Jones. That study has a list of factors that should be considered, or that Austin believes should be considered when deciding relocation. Gatekeeping, the distance of the travel, the age of the children, whether there's conflicts that have arisen, domestic violence, I believe, is one of the components.
Isn't that information that the court could glean at the time of the evidentiary hearing? To direct testimony of the parties?
And it did, Your Honor, and that was noted by the court. The court didn't need the expert evaluation on the April 2024 hearing. The court specifically said the court could get that information in other manners. And they tried to present that information in other manners, and I would assert to the court that they did present that. They made those arguments, and they presented that testimony to the court.
Ms. Roberts, why did Ms. Stumbo refuse to talk to the expert? I've never seen an explanation in the record what the harm was going to be.
I believe that
she could provide her side of the story.
Your Honor, again, I was not trial counsel. I don't know that. I did not discuss that with her.
Do you agree there's nothing in the record that explains what their objection actually is other than this Rule 35? That was the only thing I saw in the hearing transcript.
There is nothing in the record. You're correct, okay. Your Honor.
Couldn't she have submitted something in writing to the expert? ask for respond to questions if she didn't want to talk to the expert. Just submit a statement about what her point of view was about whatever the issues were.
But she had already done that in her pleadings, Your Honor. So if
all right, so then the assessment could have been done. She could just resubmit it.
I'm sorry?
The assessment could have been done. Mr. Jones stood up and said, we object. He doesn't give a reason. And then later on, he says, Rule 35.
So in the relocation risk assessment, it talks extensively about what you're supposed to do. It requires this assessment or this protocol requires them to talk to the parties, to gather information independent of what's been presented. So it's a process. I'd represent to the court that this is not a 90-day process. This is much longer than that, as indicated by the proposed stipulation order that
she ultimately prepared the report before she testified in June of 24. So she did a report. It had to be abbreviated because she couldn't talk to the parties. All she could do was the scientific theory.
Correct, Your Honor.
So it is possible to have the report done, but the court made no attempt to accommodate it, continued the trial for a couple days. And then Dr. Holland didn't even testify until the next month. And so I don't understand why the district court gave no accommodation at all to the request when this was a major decision, a life-altering decision of moving a one-year-old and a four-year-old across the country.
So the information that relocation risk assessment could have been presented and was presented in alternative ways other than Dr. Holland's testimony and Dr. Holland's evaluation report, Your Honor. It could have been, and it was. Mr. Stumbo went down those lists of relocation risk assessment factors and presented evidence at the time of the evidentiary hearing regarding that. So the court had that information. Again, it comes back to whether it was necessary for the court to rule. In this matter, Judge Henderson said it was not necessary for him to rule on that issue.
Ms. Roberts, yes. Did Logan's counsel below ever seek to depose Margaret in this case to get answers to some of the questions that might have been asked by the expert?
On April 24th, they did have discussions before Judge Henderson about if they wanted to reopen discovery for the limited purpose of taking Margaret's deposition, that they would agree to that. To the best of my knowledge, that never happened. I don't find anything in the record that would answer that question, Your Honor, whether they attempted to take the deposition or not. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Mr. Jimerson, I'm going to give you 2 minutes to respond, even though the clock said three.
I'll take any time the court is willing to provide. While a district court has discretion to make appropriate orders in advance of trial, when we deal with something like relocation, and we deal with it on a compressed timeline, the parties are left, and certainly Mr. Stumbo is left, in the unenviable position of having to make a decision. Do we try to do everything in advance of trial, or we ask for continuance, and then we're left prisoner to what we have in the meantime, which is precisely what happened? And while the district court was quite gracious to Mr. Stumbo vis-a-vis the value he placed on Dr. Holland's report, the unfortunate reality is that all of the specific, case-specific work that was done was ignored right out of the gate. There was effectively an order. The judge said, my ruling is that there will not be any opinions based upon interviews of the parties or of the children, because the court did not want the report to only have influence from one side. And the unfortunate outcome is that you have a district court that says Dr. Holland's report was the most valuable part of the relocation case for Mr. Stumbo. All the while, it's now been hamstrung by these decisions that don't allow Dr. Holland to do all the work that would be necessary to provide an appropriate evaluation. And when we talk about some of these issues, for example, the effect of relocation on a one-year-old, right? We're not talking about older children where you can actually have a meaningful discussion. We're relying upon what we understand to be the effects on very, very, very young children. And those findings, right, those opinions were not enough to cause the court to say, I'm not going to find that it is in the children's best interest for a relocation to take place. That when you have bonding problems with children this young, you are imperiling the relationship between at this point, what would be the non-custodial parent and that child. For that reason, Your Honor, we respectfully request the court reverse and remand.
Thank you.